Tis us.
Tis us. Hello and welcome to Beyond Reproach.
Wait, I thought I was starting.
You're starting. God dang it. God dang it.
Hello and welcome to Beyond Reproach. This is Stephanie Domingo.
And I'm Tuck stealing the opening Lurzel.
Rude.
That's a really stupid name. I'm going to stick with it. That's my new nickname from now on.
We be drinking and we be swearing. This is a show about scandals and scandalousness in American politics and government.
Sure is. Dang it. Swearing up a storm.
You are. Mm-hmm. You are.
So we have these fancy cocktails in front of us. It is called the Knickerbocker.
Ooh, I love that.
Yes. So it all started in 1809 when Washington Irving wrote a book under the name Diedrich Knickerbocker.
Okay.
The book was called A History of New York from the Beginning of the World to the End of the Dutch Dynasty. So this was written in 1809, so a really long history of New York.
Yeah.
The word Knickerbocker came from a style of pants that Dutch settlers used to wear.
Yes,
they were like rolled up to the knee. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but thanks to this book he wrote under that name, Diedrich Knickerbocker, the word Knickerbocker then took on a new meaning, and it basically meant anyone, sort of like upper crusty New Yorkers who could trace their ancestry back to the original Dutch settlers.
Okay.
So like at the beginning of the 1800s, that was what a Knickerbocker was. But then it sort of over time just took on another meaning, basically anything that was like really New York-y. Anything that was like quintessentially New York-y could be called, have something to do with Knickerbocker.
Like Yankees hat.
Yeah, yeah. So
he was talking about a Yankee hat.
Yes, exactly. That's totally what he meant. A Knicks hat.
Yes. Oh.
That's what where the name comes from.
Duh.
Yeah.
Wow. My mind just thought about the street that's a few blocks away.
Yeah, we're talking sports ball over here. Once it took on that meaning, anything and everything New York-y, the city, like government, started naming things Knickerbockers, naming streets Knickerbocker, naming landmarks Knickerbocker.
Of course, yeah, that makes sense.
I do live a block, not even a full block. Yeah. The closest cross street, like half a block away, is Knickerbocker Ave. But then businesses were also calling themselves Knickerbocker. There was Knickerbocker Magazine. There was a Knickerbocker Beer.
Oh.
There's a Knickerbocker Bank, a Knickerbocker Hotel.
Okay.
And yes, there is the famous sports ball team, the New York Knicks.
Yes. I believe Patrick Ewing is on that team right now.
I don't know who that is.
He's from the 90s.
Oh, okay.
And he's an old man
I
now.
Just think of of J.R. Ewing from Dallas.
Of course you would.
Who shot J.R.? Who?
Your taste tickled me.
I try. So yeah, basically anything New York-y. And if we know anything about New Yorkers, it's that New Yorkers know how to drink.
Sure do.
So in the like 1850s, newspaper articles started popping up referencing a new cocktail called the Knickerbocker cocktail. The recipe itself wasn't actually written down and published until Jerry Thomas wrote it down in 1862. That guy, he's just everywhere.
He has all of them.
Yeah.
He collects all the recipes.
He does. He did. But so we know that it was around at least a decade earlier, if not longer, because there was references to it in the 1850s in newspaper articles. So today we are drinking a Knickerbocker from the 1850s.
I love it.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Ta-da.
To New York.
When I was a kid at school, learning the golden rule, teacher often used to say, if you don't tell a lie, there's not a reason why you can't be like Washington someday. How could Washington be a married man and never, never tell a lie?
Is it good? What do you think?
It's very tart, but I love it.
Yeah.
I'm definitely tasting the lime and the citrus.
Yeah. It is made with gold rum, orange curacao, or you could also use triple sec, lime juice, and a raspberry syrup. Raspberry syrup was basically the grenadine of the 19th century before pomegranates were readily available.
It's delightful.
Yeah.
The kind of heat, the spiciness for the rum.
Yeah.
It's really nice.
I'm having a hard time tasting it. I have, since I've had COVID, I lost my sense of smell when I had COVID, and it has come back. My lost sense of smell has come back. This is now the third time that I can't taste anything. But this time, I'm actually experiencing other symptoms as well. I'm not positive for COVID. Yeah. I haven't been exposed again, but for whatever reason, my sense of taste is gone. My sense of smell is gone. And now I am tasting like really gross things as well out of nowhere. Yeah. This didn't happen the last two times that I lost my sense of smell, but this time I can smell like I smell really gross, like chemically smells and like mildew and all these horrible smells all the time. It's terrible.
Mildew is the worst. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, it's gross.
But how does this drink taste to you?
It's not great.
Oh, okay.
But it's fine. But I just can't taste much at all. Okay. So I'm just going to drink it.
Yeah.
Hopefully when I'm ready to photograph this for our Instagram, I will have my sense of taste back again and I can taste it then. The last two times that I've lost my sense of smell and taste, it only lasted for like 3 weeks. So I'm hoping it's been about 2 weeks so far. So hopefully soon.
Yeah. Fingers crossed.
Yeah.
It's no way to live. Having no taste, I think, is way better than biting into something and it tasting like mildew.
It's the weirdest stuff that smells like mildew to me too. Like
apples,
mint, chocolate. Like it's the weirdest thing.
Yeah.
Don't get COVID.
Don't get COVID.
It's so fucking weird.
Yeah. It's not a hoax.
Yeah. It was March when I got it.
Yeah,
so
you got
it's
it
been
early,
almost a year.
Like mid-March.
And I'm still going through weird side effects that are coming back.
Oh,
but anyways, yeah. So you think it's good?
I do.
Yeah.
It's sad that you can't taste it.
So there are actually a bunch of different variations on the Knickerbocker cocktail. There's also another one called the Knickerbocker Special that came like maybe a decade or two later.
The remix?
Yeah. They all are sort of plays on the same like rum, raspberry syrup, and lime. But some of the more recent variations have like pineapple juice or orange juice in them as well. But we're drinking the original sort of Jerry Thomas 1850/1862 recipe.
The lime thing, you're kind of pressing the lime. Are you going to talk about
that?
Oh, yeah.
His recipe calls for you squeeze the lime and then you take half of the lime and like smush it and put it into the drink. So there should be like a lime shell in the drink.
Yeah.
But a lot of modern bartenders like to like smush the lime shell into like a little raft and use it as a float in the drink.
Oh, okay. That's what you're trying to do.
Yeah. It's kind of cool looking as well. So today I am going to be talking about New York City in the 1850s, as you may have guessed from the Knickerbocker cocktail.
Yes.
I'm going to be talking about the construction of Central Park. So Central Park was one of America's first ever major landscaped public parks. And New York City would obviously not be the same without it. It gives people living in the densest city in the country an opportunity to go for a walk, go bird watching, to go for a picnic, you know, even just like lay in the grass and feel the sun on your skin.
To be in some simulated landscape.
Yeah, exactly.
That's not concrete.
Yeah, yeah. It's hard to find somewhere that's not shaded by a building to like lay in the grass. So it's definitely nice to have. When most people learn about the building of Central Park, they are taught that before the landscape was reshaped into this simulated, idyllic countryside, it was basically just a rocky, swampy, muddy wasteland. And there were a handful of like squatters' huts and these like ramshackle shanties. Just a few people living there, but for the most part, it was just a muddy wasteland. In reality, the land that Central Park was built on was originally home to Seneca Village. Have you heard of Seneca Village?
I have not.
I really thought that you would know this story.
No.
Okay. I'm proud that I found a story. I really thought that you would have known this.
You know my story, because everyone knows my story.
Okay.
But when I think of Seneca, I think of like Seneca Lake.
Yeah,
like
upstate New York. Yeah. So Seneca Village was one of 19th century New York's largest free black settlements.
Oh, okay.
At the time of its destruction in 1857, it had 264 residents, three churches, two cemeteries, and one of the few schools in New York that was open to black children.
Wait, what year was this?
1857.
Okay, it was right after the Civil War.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So today I would like to propose a toast to setting the record straight.
Ooh, I like that. Yeah. There we go.
So obviously we know that the sale of enslaved African people was instrumental in growing New York City into the financial hub and sort of world famous city that it was growing into in the 1800s.
So, sorry to interrupt.
No, go for it.
But because of that, New York City actually didn't have the highest banking per capita. It was New Orleans.
Really? I didn't know that. Wow.
At this time.
That makes sense.
Yeah, because enslaved people, their combined wealth was more than all of the railroads and all of the businesses in the whole country
yeah.
was like below the, like in the Mississippi Valley.
Of course. That makes complete sense because all of
New York was number two.
Yeah. And we definitely had a thriving slave trade in New York City.
Hell yeah. Poor city.
And for that reason, New York State was actually one of the last northern states to actually abolish slavery. Starting in 1799, the state passed several abolition and emancipation laws, but these laws were gradually phased in and didn't actually go into full effect for almost 30 years in 1827. So from 1799 to 1827, they were like, a percentage of the slaves have to be freed.
Yeah.
In those 30 years, the free black population in New York City tripled, and the white folks living in
Manhattan loved it.
Yeah, they were not fucking having it. Yeah, they were like, welcome. Pull up a chair. Yes, have a seat.
Like when you go to Hawaii, I've never been to Hawaii, but like they're doing like, they're putting Lays on all of them.
They were doing everything in their power to make sure that these new black transplants to New York City felt as unwelcome as humanly possible. It was nearly impossible for a black man to find anything other than like a really shitty low-wage job, because all black people were basically unofficially banished from any skilled trades. Mm-hmm. Most free black people for that reason had to rent rooms or apartments in the poor neighborhoods in Brooklyn and in Manhattan, especially in the Five Points District, the infamous Five Points District that Charles Dickens once described as a place of poverty, wretchedness, and vice.
Ooh.
The press was also constantly whining about the growing black population in Manhattan. And the founder of the New York Enquirer once wrote that the free Negroes of this city are a nuisance incomparably greater than a million slaves.
Wow.
Like, are slaves a nuisance? Because it seems like they're doing your work for you. So
I know.
So everything is more of a nuisance than slaves, right?
Yeah, you would think.
So white New Yorkers were constantly attacking African-American institutions. They were torching churches.
What?
Yeah. You surprise. it's an American tradition.
Yeah. This is very similar to my story.
Really? Well, for those of you who haven't caught on yet, it's February, so it's Black History Month. Yours is sort of a similar era.
Similar time period.
Yeah.
Right after the war.
Okay. So they were also doing everything that they could to block the building of black schools so that black children couldn't get educated.
You have to keep them in their place.
Yeah, exactly. So when the state legislature passed yet another abolition law in 1817, racial terrorism just got even worse, significantly worse.
Yeah.
And at this point, there were slave catchers just sort of like roaming the streets trying to kidnap any black people that they could find, whether they were actual escaped runaway slaves or free black men living in New York. That's like the plot of
Solomon Northam.
Yeah. 12 Years a Slave.
Northup. Yeah.
We just watched that. Well, not just several months ago. We were on
Peculiar Picture Show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great episode if you guys are interested.
Yeah. We did it over the summer. I think like July or something.
I can't remember exactly what month it came out, but just go look on their catalog for 12 Years a Slave. So the white folks in New York were also very worried about the potential political power of such a large free black population congregating in the same area.
They weren't allowing them to vote in New York.
Yeah. So they basically passed a law. The state legislature passed a law saying that black men could only gain the right to vote if they owned property valued at least $250 and had paid taxes on that property for at least 3 years.
Okay.
So even if you were able to buy property, you had to wait 3 years before you could vote.
Yeah. People think the North was so liberal, and it's like, most certainly wasn't, like, at all.
At the same time that they did this, they actually loosened property requirements for white men, of course.
Yeah. You have to maintain white supremacy.
Surprising no one.
At all. Yes.
This basically meant that at the time that this law passed, only 16 black men in all of Manhattan had the right to vote.
Wow.
16.
That's sad.
If a black man was lucky enough to find a lucrative skill trade or find someone that was willing to pay him well or to start his own business in some way and make his own money.
Burn down.
Yeah, exactly. Even if they were somehow able to find money enough to pull themselves up by their bootstraps,
yes.
white landowners still basically refused to sell to black buyers.
Yeah, this is reminding me of Harry Belafonte. Do you know about him?
Yeah, well, I know of him, but I don't know.
He was not able to buy a home in Harlem every time he went there, even though he had the money.
In Harlem.
Wow. Yeah. But this was later.
I was going to say by then you would think that things would have gotten better, but yeah. I guess not.
He had his white lawyer go and sign the deed, and then he showed up with the money and bought a whole building just so he could have places to give to his friends, basically, that they were allowed to rent from him.
That's crazy.
He had to buy a whole building.
Yeah. Oh, this country. Yeah. So yeah, most landowners were refusing to sell to white buyers, but then
Black buyers.
Well, yes, black buyers. In 1825, a white couple named John and Elizabeth Whitehead decided that they were going to sell lots from their farmstead in northern Manhattan, basically to anyone who had the money to buy it.
Yeah.
This was just 2 years before emancipation went into full effect. Mm-hmm. And they were like, you know what? I don't care. We just want to sell this.
Yeah.
If you have money, come buy it.
Your money works too.
Yeah, exactly. So their farm was in the rocky countryside in northern Manhattan. It was about a 6-mile walk from downtown or 4 miles from the city's northern border.
This is in the Bronx?
No, it would have been roughly 80.
So 6 miles is kind of a lot.
Yeah. It's from 83rd Street to 88th Street was sort of where their farm was.
Okay.
83rd to 88th and between 7th and 8th Ave.
Okay, cool. West side.
But the downtown at that point would have been all the way, as far south in Manhattan as you can get. So
okay, that makes sense.
Midtown didn't exist yet.
Yeah.
The northern border of where people were willing to live in New York City was 26th Street. That's as far as you could go.
I feel like this is a very New York moment that we're having.
Yeah. Yeah, people that are not from New York are I have no idea.
I'm how close to Macy's was it?
Yes, exactly. South of the Empire State Building. Okay. The Empire State Building did not yet exist. It was literally just a rocky farm that they were selling. So the first lots were sold to a man named Andrew Williams. He was a 25-year-old shoeshine, and he bought 3 lots for $125.
Oh, wow.
Yes. But this was in 1825.
Yeah, that is a lot of money.
Yeah.
That's a lot of,
The very next day after he bought those 3 lots, the word got around that the Whiteheads were selling to black buyers.
Yeah.
And a store clerk named Epiphany Davis bought 12 lots for $578. Wow. And then within the week, the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church bought 6 lots. Mm. And over the next 10 years, the Whiteheads sold another 24 lots to black buyers.
Wow.
Both Andrew Williams and Epiphany Davis were prominent members of the New York African Society for Mutual Relief, which their goal, at least in part, was to help build thriving black communities. Mm-hmm. The more members that found out about the land that they were buying, they wanted to buy into it too. They wanted to follow their lead. So just more and more lots started being
They probably put it in the black papers.
Yeah, yeah.
Where it got around.
In some cases, there were black men who lived further south in Manhattan and just wanted to buy land so that they could eventually gain the right to vote. So they were buying lots from the Whiteheads, never intending to actually live up there. Mm-hmm. They just wanted to own something so that they could get the right to vote. One prominent abolitionist named Albro Lyons did just that. He bought some lots from the Whiteheads so that he could vote eventually, but never lived in Seneca. Or at least he may have lived there towards the end, but in the beginning, when he first bought the lots, he never intended to live there. Lyons was later recognized as a conductor of the Underground Railroad.
Oh.
And many people suspect that the AME Zion Church that was built in Seneca Village had a secret room in the basement for hiding runaway slaves.
Enslaved people.
Yes, enslaved people.
Yeah.
As people were buying these lots of land, houses were being built sort of slowly. Some of them were impressive 2 or 3 story.
Whoa.
Single family homes with gardens and barns. And
so this is 1860?
They were selling them in the 1820s.
Oh, so early. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
1825 was the first lot was sold in 1825.
Okay.
There were these big sort of upper middle class homes with gardens and barns and stuff. And then some of them were just modest shacks, whatever people could afford to put up. But either way, no matter what they were building on this land, The area offered open space and fresh air and clean drinking water.
Oh, wow.
In very stark contrast to the conditions in these like
tenements.
Crowded, filthy tenements to the south.
Yeah.
In the south of Manhattan, the tenements and the slums were becoming increasingly dangerous for Black people to live anyway. So people were trying to find a way out.
Mm-hmm.
The area that became Seneca Village just kept growing. And eventually there were 50 homes, 3 churches, 2 cemeteries, and a school, Colored School Number 3, which was one of the few schools available for Black children at the time.
Yeah.
More than 3/4 of the children living in Seneca Village attended.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Thanks to the sort of unique conditions in Seneca Village, Black people who were living there had an opportunity to prosper and to do well for themselves
mm-hmm.
in a way that people living in other parts of the city just couldn't.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't have these same opportunities.
Because they were building their own community, right?
Exactly.
And like servicing that community.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. By 1855, around half of the residents owned their own property.
Wow.
At a rate 5 times higher than the city average.
Oh, uh-oh.
The economic background of Seneca Village was also very diverse. Like I said, there were some like really sort of fancy upper middle class homes.
Mm-hmm.
Some people were very well-to-do, but there was also a lot of people that worked in service, worked in domestic service or food service. People worked in construction.
Yeah.
It was just, you know, anyone who could afford to buy or rent in Seneca Village would go
there.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
Nice.
In the 1840s, around the time of the Irish potato famine, some Irish and German immigrants started moving to Seneca Village too.
Okay.
Because they were immigrants and their English wasn't super great when they first moved, well, the German immigrants especially, they were also facing discrimination and marginalization from white people in other parts of the city.
Yeah.
And while Irish immigrants living in close proximity to free Black men and women in the south of Manhattan, there was often tension and often violence between these groups.
Mm-hmm.
In Seneca Village, they actually formed a basically like a peaceful, integrated community. White residents attended the All Angels Episcopal Church with their Black neighbors.
They didn't grow up with white supremacy.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's learned behavior.
Yeah.
Give them time.
Yeah. One historian described the interracial church as a testament to a new social and political reality. So the Black and white parishioners sat side by side in the same pews in the same church. They were baptized together in the same ceremonies. They were buried together in the same cemeteries.
Oh my God, they let water touch both of their bodies?
I know, yeah. The only midwife in Seneca Village was an Irish immigrant who serviced both Black and white mothers. And there are even records of interracial marriage in Seneca Village. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just like a big deal in the
1820s
through 50s. So by 1850, census and property records show that the population of Seneca Village was around 264. 30% of the people living there were European, mostly Irish.
Mm-hmm.
But that same census shows that there were 12,000 Black people living in New York City. Of that 12,000, only 100 of them had the right to vote.
Oh my God.
And 10 of that 100 lived in Seneca Village.
Okay.
So 10% of the entire voting population of Black New Yorkers lived in this tiny village of less than 300 people. It sounds pretty incredible. It sounds like utopia.
Yeah.
But utopia can't last forever.
No, definitely not.
At the same time that Seneca Village was growing, the same pressures that were pushing Black people out of Lower Manhattan were also pushing the wealthy north. Between 1821 and 1855, the population of New York City had quadrupled. And thanks to the Irish potato famine, the tenements in Lower Manhattan were basically just overflowing.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the neighborhoods were pushing north. So by the 1840s, neighborhoods that were south of 14th Street that had been previously very sort of like hoity-toity and well-to-do were becoming less and less desirable because, you know, the
poor. Too close to the poor.
Yeah, yes. The poor were showing up.
They're coming.
The wealthy started looking towards northern Manhattan and sort of planning to build these big grand mansions like as far away from the poor as they possibly could. We need to get so far north that the poor will never touch us. We won't even have to look at them.
You'll have to see their dirty hands.
Yeah. Ugh. Get a nail brush already.
Seriously.
New York's elite at this time was also very well traveled, and they were very jealous of the big manicured public parks in the major European cities, like Paris's Bois de Boulogne, Berlin's Tiergarten, and London's Hyde Park. The fashion in Europe at the time was for the wealthy to go through these parks to picnic and promenade and ride their carriages through the park as a way to sort of like show off, to show their wealth.
Yeah, I forgot this is like carriage times.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They're literally going to the park basically to see and be seen.
Yeah, to show out.
Yeah, strut their stuff. They needed to. So rich New Yorkers wanted to strut their stuff too. Mm-hmm. What's, you know, that's not fair.
No, why do it these isn't.
Stupid Europeans think they're so cool?
They think they're so cool with their accents. They're like, oi!
Hello, governor!
I want to say some in it. In it. Yeah. Oh, Kim, please strike all of this.
Nope. So in the 1840s, clean, green outdoor space was so rare in New York City that the wealthy here started going to do their promenading in cemeteries instead. So that's why cemeteries in Brooklyn, like Greenwood, are so beautiful.
Greenwood is stunning.
It's gorgeous.
Okay.
These cemeteries have, especially Greenwood, has these meandering paths, mature landscaping, giant trees.
It's so hilly there, too.
Ponds.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's beautiful. There's these like giant Victorian stone outbuildings. Mm-hmm. All the mausoleums for the rich people are so ostentatious and so like just one is more over the top than the last one.
Yeah.
But it's because people were literally just strolling through them as if they were a public park in the 1840s.
That's so weird, but I get it.
That's just what you did because they
did.
Public parks didn't weren't really
that's
a thing
you
yet.
Had.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. The wealthy were using these cemeteries to flex. Even from the grave, they were like building these mausoleums to literally like show off from the other side.
No, it's called stunting on those hoes.
Yes. Look at how drippy I am.
No.
Gross. Oh,
what have you done?
Think about drippy dead people.
Oh,
no. Oh, God. So at this point, like in the 1840s and 1850s, all the like richy riches and the influential New Yorkers and politicians started writing editorials in the newspapers trying to basically shame New York City into building a grand public park for their use. Because they wanted to knock those smug-ass Europeans down a peg.
Mm-hmm.
A passage from one newspaper said, "Give us a park, be it central or sidelong, here, there, anywhere. A real park, a large park."
Yes.
And privileged New Yorkers very much agreed. And then real estate developers started looking into their crystal balls and realized that the land bordering such a grand park could make them a fucking fortune.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
So the next thing you knew, the Special Committee on Parks was formed to survey possible sites. The first site that they looked at was still very big, but it was definitely smaller than Central Park. The problem was that some rich families had already started building homes there.
Can't take their homes.
Yep. They got an injunction against the committee to make them stop planning for this area. So then the committee had to look for a second site, and they settled on the 750-acre area that they were referring to as the Central Park. The boundaries of this proposed site were between 59th Street and 106th Street and 5th and 8th Ave. The park eventually was expanded up until 110th Street, but originally it just went to 106th.
Okay.
There were, of course, objections to this location, too. We know that Seneca Village was already there.
Yeah.
But Seneca Village was actually not the only settlement in the area at the time. This is a big chunk of land.
Oh, yeah. It's a huge area of land. Yeah. There would have to be a bunch of people.
Yeah. There was another settlement called Harsonville. There was the Piggery District. The Convent of the Sisters of Charity. There was a public hospital. And in the more remote areas, there were even industries like leather tanneries, and there was a bone boiling operation.
Okay.
All together, there were 1,600 people living in the proposed site of Central Park.
The Central Park.
But Seneca Village was definitely the most developed and the most densely populated. A social reformer at the time named Hal Guernsey once asked, Will anyone pretend the park is not a scheme to enhance the value of uptown land and create a splendid center for fashionable life without regard to and even in dereliction of the happiness of the multitude upon whose hearts and hands the expenses will fall?
Correct.
Yes. Unfortunately, none of the people objecting to this location were rich.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the plan gained support. And in 1853, the New York State Legislature passed the Central Park Act. A board of five commissioners was set up to start purchasing land from the people who owned it already and to start raising money for the Central Park Fund. But this is at a time before the subway system, before automobiles.
Yeah, definitely.
So this is before transportation was fast or affordable. The general public basically knew that this park was being built much too far north for average working class people to ever get the chance to enjoy it. They knew, they could see that this was being built for basically exclusively for the enjoyment of the wealthy.
Yeah. I forget that without a subway, like how the fuck do you get all the way up
there? Yeah, it was 6 miles from the tip of Manhattan to the very base of...
Like I wouldn't even walk from 34th to the top of, to the bottom of the park at 59th.
Yeah.
Like that's... I would take the subway.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And most people didn't have carriages at this point either. The average people didn't. It was only rich people. So this was not being built for working class people. The newspapers realized that they needed to do something to get the poors on the side of the rich people. So they started publishing these smear campaigns against the people living inside the boundaries of this proposed park site. They started referring to the settlements in Central Park as shanty towns, inhabited by wretched and debased squatters and bloodsuckers.
We know what that means.
They conveniently left out the fact that people living in Seneca Village had owned and paid taxes on their property for over decades. That was just completely left out.
It was lies.
Yeah, exactly.
These people didn't know. They're separated.
No, they've never been there. Yeah. That's like traveling to another country at this point. Like, why would they ever go that far north? So the park's first engineer wrote a report, and in it he disparaged the refuge of 5,000 squatters, who, he said, had very little knowledge of the English language and very little respect for the law. And as if the colorful language that all these reports were using was not enough, the newspapers also started saying that the proposed park site was filled with disease to try and get people to turn their backs on them. An article in the New York Daily Times said, "If some of the hogs, goats, and other inmates of the shanties in this vicinity do not die of the yellow fever this summer, it will only be because death himself hesitates to enter such dirty hovels."
Wow. And I like that the New York Daily was doing that back then.
Yeah, yeah.
They're still doing that now?
This is the New York Daily Times. I'm not sure if it's the same.
Oh, okay, okay.
I would imagine this is probably now defunct.
Yes, okay. But how? They're doing such great journalism.
Fair and unbalanced. Yes. You know, with colorful language like that, the campaigns against the shanty towns in the proposed site very successful. There were a lot of like actual squatters' huts and shanties and stuff there too, because this was literally a huge site and previously like almost completely undeveloped. Mm-hmm. But the settlements in these towns it was like the Wild West up there. So there were little villages. Mm-hmm. Like you can't just say everyone is 5,000 squatters. Dude, fuck you.
Yeah.
But nobody's up there. Nobody's checking this out. And I know that the reporters were also not even bothering to go up there and check either.
Yeah.
So the campaign was a success, and the working class public eventually was persuaded that these dangerous, disease-ridden shanty towns needed to be wiped off the map.
Gotta protect ourselves.
Yeah. Otherwise, we're all going to die of yellow fever.
Yeah.
The legislature authorized taking the land by eminent domain. Yes, and set aside $5 million to buy out the current property owners and give them the boot. A committee was set up to draw up a map of the park site. Mm-hmm. They figured out the boundaries of all the lots that everybody was on, and they noted the types of houses and outbuildings on each lot so that they would be able to figure out how to value each lot of land and how much to pay for each lot. The average lot was valued at around $700. but larger lots, corner lots, and really well-developed lots were worth more.
Yeah, like the hospital and probably like the church and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. The property owners tried to fight this. They tried to
save their
homes and save their communities.
Yeah.
But they were also saying that this committee was intentionally undervaluing their lots. And they knew that their lots were worth more. At this point, you know, a lot of these people originally bought them in 1825, but at this point, this is 30 years later.
Oh,
so
wow.
Their lots were worth a lot more. Plus, they had invested in them. Yeah. They built homes and, you know what I mean? Like, you can't say that they're only worth $700 now.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely not.
A lot of the owners, they for 2 years, they petitioned the courts. And they appealed all these decisions. They were trying to save their community. But they knew that if it wasn't possible to save their communities, they at least just wanted to get market value for their land.
Of course. Yeah. That's bare minimum.
Yeah. But they lost. They got the shaft. Andrew Williams, the first person who bought those three lots for $125 30 years before, said that his land was now worth nearly $4,000.
Yeah.
Because he had improved it so much and the value of
30 years is a lot of time.
Plus, so there was so much more development that far north at this point that like just having development nearby significantly raised the value of your own land. $4,000 isn't even that much in my opinion, but he argued
Did he get?
Yeah. He argued his case for that amount.
When
he was finally kicked out in April 1856, he got $2,335. And most property owners went through the same thing. Nobody really got what their land was worth. Everybody kind of got the shaft.
Yeah.
But they still, the property owners still fared way better than people who were renting in Seneca Village and the other settlements.
Oh, yeah.
Because you have to think, at this time, there were no cars. There were no, like, moving vans.
Mm-hmm.
You have to pick up and move your entire life and your livelihood somewhere else. And it's not going to be close because everyone else around you is rich.
Yeah. No one wants to sell to you or rent to you.
Yeah.
Like,
so not only is moving at this point incredibly inconvenient, it's also very expensive.
Yeah.
And they got a big fat fucking zilch from the state to be forced out of their homes. In the summer of 1856, Mayor Fernando Wood sent a final notice to anyone who was still remaining in the proposed park site, saying that they needed to get the fuck out.
Yeah.
And then in 1857, he sent the police to beat them out if they hadn't left yet. One newspaper published an article celebrating the violent clearing of the park and the glorious victory over the people that had lived there.
Okay.
They said that this glorious victory would not be forgotten, as many a brilliant and stirring fight was had during the campaign, and the supremacy of law was upheld by the policemen's bludgeons.
Yeah.
So then, October 1st, 1857, the city announced that the last holdouts were finally gone. Newspapers cheered the removal of the insects and praised the violence methods that the police had used to get rid of them. So at this point, finally, all of the settlements could be demolished and destroyed, and construction could officially start on the park. The two cemeteries in Seneca Village were supposed to have been relocated, but there's no record of any exhumations.
Ugh.
Yes.
Well, I guess I shouldn't be too surprised by that.
Yeah. One historian said that the story of Seneca Village was eclipsed by the cultural forgetting that often cuts Black achievements out of history.
Yeah.
They said that the settlement was, quote, effectively erased from the memory of New York City. And this happened really quickly. Once people were gone, the park wasn't even finished yet. By the time people had, like, if you said Seneca Village, people would have no fucking clue what you were talking about. Within a decade, people are like, what's that?
Whoa.
Completely forgotten. In August of 1871, that would have been like 13, 14 years after they started construction, landscapers building a new entrance to the park at 85th Street and 8th Avenue were digging the footings and found two coffins. And the New York Herald published an article saying that the discovery of these two coffins was a complete mystery. We have no idea how these coffins could have gotten there.
One coffin, okay. But also
this,
not okay.
This was literally 15 years earlier was the site of the AME Zion Church's graveyard. And people, there were records of this.
Of course. 15 years, even 20 years isn't a lot of time that you could.
It's a complete mystery. Nobody knows how it's even possible.
The world will never know.
Yes. 50 years later, another gardener in Central Park found even more coffins in the same location. But, you know, the bottom line is Seneca Village is gone. Seneca Village was buried underneath this.
So they never just grabbed those coffins?
They're still there.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Seneca Village is buried under this like highly artificial landscape that looks
super manicured.
Yeah. But looks natural even though it never was.
Yeah.
It's under this beautiful park, but it's just down there buried.
That's just a metaphor for everything.
Yeah, exactly. I know. Yeah. So the story of Seneca Village and the people who lived there was almost completely forgotten to history, and we would not know the story today if it were not for two historians who wrote a book in 1992 called The Park and the People, A History of Central Park.
Yeah, I had never heard about this.
Yeah.
Did you know?
I've seen like articles about it recently. Yeah.
Okay.
Vox put out a video about it.
Like when you said Seneca, I'm like, oh, maybe it's like Native American people.
No. Because apparently the name Seneca has something to do with this philosophy book that was really popular with abolitionists.
Okay.
I think that that's why
they named it that.
That's why they named it that. But I think that also may have something to do with a lot of the other towns in upstate New York being
that are named Seneca. Okay.
Yeah. So these two historians wrote The Park and the People, A History of Central Park. And this was a history that most people had never heard before. People's minds were fucking completely blown, especially New Yorkers who, you know, people that lived blocks away from this had never heard of the story before. Yeah. And people were like,
wait,
what the fuck?
There's like buried people there?
Yeah, exactly.
Excuse me?
So a few years after this book came out, the Seneca Village Project was formed specifically to raise awareness about Seneca Village's significance as a free middle-class black community in 19th century New York City.
Yeah, are there any markers in the park?
Yeah, in 2001 for Black History Month, the city unveiled the Seneca Village Memorial Plaque. It's near a playground near the entrance of 85th Street in Central Park West.
Okay.
That same year, 2001, the Seneca Village Project started working on a grant-funded research project. It started with gathering paper documents to get their sort of ducks in a row. But the goal was to start an excavation in 2011.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah. It's the very least they can do.
Yeah. So they unearthed 250 bags of artifacts from the village. They went through and like they did not metal detectors, but sort of like echolocation or something. And they could find where the foundations of the buildings were.
Oh, yeah.
And dug out the homes and started digging up all the like the pottery and all the stuff that were in people's homes when they left. And these artifacts really tell a real story about the quality of life of the people who lived in Seneca Village.
Oh, wow.
And one of the directors of the project said, when people talked about the people of Seneca Village at the time, they tended to denigrate them. But what you can see from when you look at their dishes is that they were not that different from the white middle class. They found all of these like really fine porcelain dishes. And apparently this one pattern was really popular. They had also done an excavation in the West Village at some point, and they found the exact same pattern in a lot of the homes that were in the West Village. So it was clear that, you know, these sort of upper middle class black families were living parallel lives to the white upper middle class.
Yeah.
They also found combs and toothbrushes and things that in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s, poor people didn't own toothbrushes. Toothbrushes didn't really become readily used by sort of everyone until like the 1920s.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Okay.
So like if you had a toothbrush, you were rich.
Yeah.
Basically doing this research and doing these excavations proved that, you know, the newspapers were all saying that everybody was poor and they all were all living in shanties, but these excavations prove that these people were much more affluent than even historians had ever believed possible.
Mm, okay.
But unfortunately, Seneca Village is lost.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of tracks with, in my mind, why they'd want to destroy it.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Because it's like, this is too nice for you.
Yeah. I don't necessarily think it would have happened the same way if it hadn't been for this park plan. They probably would have just forced them out.
I guess there's such a long history of just affluent areas being destroyed by white people.
100%. Yeah.
And it's not just Tulsa. Like, this happened everywhere.
Yeah.
It's like, you can only get so far before people need to destroy what you have.
Yeah, absolutely. As the city was moving north.
But it was integrated, so maybe it was different there.
I think what would have happened was as the city moved north and more wealthy people moved further north, they would have just been sort of like...
displaced.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
As those areas developed more and more, I think eventually they would have been like, you're not supposed to be here.
Yeah.
Just go away now. Or I'll buy you out. You know what I mean? Either way, Seneca Village is buried under the park.
Yeah.
There are no photographs of Seneca Village.
No.
Nobody knows exactly what it looked like other than like the outlines of the foundations and stuff.
So many things have been lost to history.
Yeah. I'm glad that it's finally being researched and talked about.
Absolutely.
And publicized now in a way that it never has before. But I'm also happy to learn that there was another, even larger free black settlement in Brooklyn called Weeksville that was founded in 1838.
Like Weeksville, like the area in Brooklyn?
Yeah.
Okay.
One of the largest free black communities in pre-Civil War America. And the last few remaining buildings from the settlement were still standing, but slated for demolition in 1968, but they were saved by preservationists.
Oh, that's good.
And today, Weeksville stands as a museum and a teaching facility.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah. I really want to go check it out.
Yeah.
It's like, it's still there. It looks really cool. I've looked at their website and stuff. We need to go check it out.
I randomly saw that when I was looking for apartments 3 years ago. I'm just like, Weeksville? Like, what's that?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like a whole area. I'm like, oh, okay. My bad. I'd never heard of it.
Yeah, but it's named after, there was originally one of the largest free black settlements.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
We need to go.
Yeah.
We need to go.
There's only a few buildings that are still there, but
like
there was just this strip of buildings that was supposed to be demolished. And they're like, no, this is important. Like, calm down.
Yeah. So thank you for that. I had no clue.
Story of Seneca Village.
I had no clue. This is, I feel more knowledgeable.
Yes.
And I, shame on me for not knowing this. But also people 15 years later didn't know.
Yeah.
So I guess I shouldn't feel so bad.
No, people only started realizing this until like only recently.
Trash. Yeah.
But lately, I don't know, maybe it's because I started researching it. I feel like
you see it everywhere.
I see it constantly
now.
Everybody's talking about Seneca Village.
Your iPhone is telling everyone.
Yeah, exactly. Hey.
He needs more Weeksville content.
Yes, exactly. Oh, all right. Let's have another drink.
Yeah.
Get back to it.
Welcome to Hashtag History. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Leah. And if you're a history nerd
or even a history hater,
this is the podcast for you.
Even if history was your least favorite subject in school, we can guarantee you will like this podcast because we talk about all the things that your history textbooks did not.
Things like how the bonnie Prince Charles and his Jacobite uprising was a bit of a disaster.
Yeah, or how the pharaoh Akhenaten was so disliked by Egyptians that they literally purged his name from nearly all of their records and pretended like he had never existed.
And we do all of this while drinking and rating a custom-made cocktail specific to that week's topic.
So grab a drink, take a seat, and hang out with us each week as we learn all about history's greatest stories of controversy,
conspiracy,
and corruption.
Okie doke.
Yes.
We're back with fresh cocktails.
I'm still thinking about that accent, you guys.
Hello, governor.
My favorite
thing.
What?
They say that all the time. Y'all right?
Yeah, totally. Totally 2021. Everyone is saying that. I like my favorite British thing to say.
Oh, no.
Oh, God. I like that I'm just keeping it going.
Yeah.
Like, I just wish I had said, think it through, bruv.
Yeah.
It sounds like fink, think it through, bruv.
This is not a posh accent, though. These are not the people promenading through
Hyde Park. No, I'm doing an accent of the brown English folks.
Yeah. Good times.
Good times. So in honor of Black History Month, I want to talk about an event that happened over 150 years ago.
Oakley-dokley.
Yeah, Oakley-dokley. That is the response that you should have.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of obsessed with these like pivot point moments in history that kind of give us a glimpse into an alternate world. that's kind of my wheelhouse. The 1944 DNC was that. Yes. And also, like, Woodreadith. Like, what would have happened if Woodrow wasn't so fucking sick?
Yeah, seriously.
So, yeah, my story this episode is one of those moments. Mm-hmm. So, at the heart of my scandal is a really radical experiment that happened right at the end of the Civil War on Georgia's Sea Islands. Are you familiar with...
I'm going to keep my mouth shut until I know more.
Okay. It's on St. Catherine's Island specifically.
Oh, no. I don't know if I know this.
Okay. Yes. You know this.
Okay.
So this event happened before Reconstruction and was incredibly revolutionary because it involved some pretty straight reparations in the form of land.
Really?
I'm talking 40 acres and a mule, y'all.
Oh, of course I do.
Yes. The federal plan that divided up plantations and gave each freed person their own plot of land.
Duh. Okay. Yeah. I just needed to hear those words.
Yes. Everyone knows this.
Yes.
But it wasn't a lot of land considering that time period.
Yeah.
But it was something. It was a gesture.
I mean, 40 acres is significant. It was, I mean, when we're talking like 1,000-acre plantations, no, 40 acres is nothing, but
yeah. At the same time, do you know anything about the Homestead Acts?
Like when they were going out west, they were given, what was it, 200 acres?
160 acre plots
to
white people. It was a way to force Native Americans off their land by giving it to others.
Yes.
Yeah. So 40 acres is something, but it's, I don't know, it's very complicated.
Yeah.
So in broad strokes, most of us know about the 40 acres, but few of us know that this idea came from the Black community.
Oh.
And that it actually happened. Did you know that? I didn't know that.
I definitely have heard of like the plan for it, but I did not know that it had happened.
Yeah, freed men and women divided up land, planted crops, started schools, established their own local government, and created a new free society where they could not only just survive, but thrive together as a community.
Wow. Look at the parallels between our stories again.
Yes.
We always do this.
We're on that wavelength. It's like... You take the North, I take the South.
Yeah, exactly. Look, we built Utopia twice, and then we paved over it.
Yes. Isn't that a Joni Mitchell song?
Oh, yeah.
We paved paradise?
Paved paradise, yeah.
And put up a parking lot. So this scandal shows that for a brief moment in U.S. history, the country did the right thing and not the profitable thing.
Wow.
Some of the property of the wealthiest people were given over to the poorest.
Really?
Yes. Okay. The scandal of what happened to the land shows so much of what was possible at this one critical moment in time and what Reconstruction could have been.
Yeah, Reconstruction.
If this country wasn't really about freedom and justice for all of its citizens, Reconstruction is a big one.
Yeah.
Let's raise a glass to a quote I kept thinking about after researching this story. It comes from Nicole Hannah Jones's essay. Oh. She did that 1619 project. Mm-hmm. So this is from her essay. She said, "It would be historically inaccurate to reduce the contributions of Black people to the vast material wealth created by our bondage. Black Americans have also been and continue to be foundational to the idea of American freedom. More than any other group in this country's history, we have served generation after generation in an overlooked but vital role. It is we who have been the perfectors of this democracy."
Wow.
Cheers.
Yeah. Good times. I'm already depressed.
Oh, don't be depressed. Don't be depressed. It's a good story. And it's not as bad as it. You think it is.
Okay. After.
Or at least you can be the judge at the end, I guess.
After knowing what happened in Seneca Village, I'm just like, I know what's going to happen.
You do know what's going to happen. So do you remember General Sherman from my Lincoln scandal? Mm-hmm. He's the one who had that. It's called the March to the Sea.
Yeah.
Where he marched his troops from Atlanta to Savannah, burning all the Target and Chase banks he could see.
No! As God is my witness, I will never accept this long-ass motherfucking receipt again.
So in the final months of the Civil War, Sherman had a problem because he had marched his 60,000 soldiers from Atlanta to Savannah, and along the way, a lot of newly freed Black people just started following the army. Like, I'm just going to stick next to you guys.
Yeah.
Like, when we're next to you, like, no one hurts us.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
yikes.
He gets all the way down to Savannah. It's just like, what do I do with all of these people?
Yeah.
So, on January 12th, 1865, Sherman and the Secretary of War at the time, his name was Edwin Stanton.
Oh, yeah. That's the guy, the impeachment story of Andrew Johnson. Edwin Stanton was the one they were like protecting from Andrew Johnson.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay. The Secretary of War.
Yes. Oh. So yeah, him and Stanton, they got together with some black clergy and community leaders in Savannah to hatch a plan. So yeah, so these white dudes like wanted to get their opinion. Wow. Their like black ass opinion on what we should do with this 10,000 people now were in Savannah that had followed the army.
Yeah.
They're like, you know, you need to help us out. We need to hatch a plan. We need to figure this situation out.
So they just didn't like drop them there. I'm like, bye.
I'm surprised they didn't. They didn't. Again, this is a really weird moment in time. Like nothing makes sense to me.
Yeah.
And I kind of love it.
They're like, I'm going to get on my private jet and fly back to DC.
Yeah. Bye. Bye. So their chosen spokesman was the Reverend Garrison Fraser, who I'm not going to talk about because I might return to him at a later date. He did a lot of things in Savannah. So when he was asked what the community most wanted, his answer was land.
Yeah.
I want land, obviously.
Yeah.
He said, the best way we can take care of ourselves is to have land and turn and till it by our own labor, and we can soon maintain ourselves and have something to spare. We want to be placed on land until we are able to buy it and make it our own.
Oh, wow.
So they didn't even want, like, handouts. They're like...
He wanted to be able to work it until they raised the money to buy it outright.
Yeah, at a fair price. Yeah, they're just like, we want to buy this land. We want you to secure it for us so we can buy it at a later date.
Wow.
I know. Right? I was shocked to learn that, but I'm like, yes, of course. Just help us get some land and like, we'll be good. Like, you won't fucking see us.
Yeah.
We'll be good. So Malcolm X has this really amazing quote that came up in my research. He said, revolution is based on land. Land is the basis of all independence. Land is the basis of freedom, justice, and equality.
Wow.
And it's true.
Yeah.
It's just like, give us our own land and then we can do the American thing. Like the promise of this country is that regular people should be able to buy land and, you know, build themselves up from that. So Sherman and Stanton, they had another important question for the Reverend. They asked, like, hey, do you want to live, like, mix in with white people, or do you want to be, like, off by yourself? And, like, without missing a beat, he's like, off by ourselves, please.
100%, yeah.
We want to live?
Yeah.
We want to live? So he said, I would prefer to live by ourselves, for there is a prejudice against us in the South that will take years to get over.
Years.
Bless his, I know. Bless his heart.
Centuries, millennia.
He's as sweet as pot. Years.
Yeah.
Just give him a few years. They'll come around.
It'll be fine.
It'll be fine.
Checks my watch. It is now 2021.
It is not fine. So 4 days later, Sherman issued Special Field Order Number 15, and this spelled out all of the plans for these people, and President Lincoln approved it.
Okay.
So the field order was extremely straightforward. It outlined area where the 400,000 miles of mostly coastal land was located. It included 100-plus chain of tidal and barrier islands from South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida. It said that this land was reserved exclusively for the settlement of the Negro, now made free by the acts of war and the proclamation of the President of the United States.
Barrier islands, though.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that not be great for, like, growing crops? It's all sandy and salty and...
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
It seems like they were, prior to the war, they were growing cotton.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, in these areas. It's weird, because I looked at a map, and most of these islands are just, like, coastal kind of outcrops.
Okay.
They're like little, almost like bays.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
They were able to grow crops there. So yeah, he's just saying like, hey, the proclamation has freed all these people, which it hasn't. If you've listened to episode 22, you know that, you know, the proclamation kind of wasn't shit, but it's okay. In any case, the field order, it spelled out that these new communities would be only for black people, governed only by black people.
Okay.
And that white Americans weren't allowed on this island unless they were there in a military capacity temporarily.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, all of this is written down. And it's really, I think it's only 6 paragraphs, this order.
Okay.
And it's very explicit.
If it's only 6 paragraphs, that's cut and dry.
Yeah. Most importantly, it said that each family shall have a plot of no more than 40 acres of tillable ground, the possession of which land the military authorities will afford them protection until such time as they can protect themselves. By the laws of war and the orders of the President of the United States, the Negro is free and must be dealt with as such.
Wow.
Sounds great, right?
On paper, it yes. sounds lovely.
So Sherman, he later agreed to give these black farmers, lend them mules, army mules, to help till the land.
Okay.
So that's where we get the 40 acres and a mule.
Okay.
It wasn't in the original document.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, not being strangers to hard work, they got busy instantly.
Yeah.
Like, okay, you're letting us be on this land. Like, bye. Like, yeah. I'm a cloud of smoke right now. Yeah. Like, there's dust in your mouth. Like, yeah. I've run so fast. The Lincoln administration, they sent a man named Tunis Campbell to the Sea Islands. They had been abandoned since 1861.
And what year was this?
1865.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, there were a lot of little islands, well, outcroppings that were abandoned. A lot of shady shit was happening on them. But this island was kind of okay.
Yeah.
So their freed men and women were building a new society for themselves on this, you know, land that was abandoned since 1861. So who is Tunis Campbell? He was an abolitionist reverend from New Jersey. He was born free in New Jersey.
Hmm.
I will definitely be returning to him because he did a lot of really like badass revolutionary shit. But a fun fact for you, he wrote a book on hotel management.
Ooh, ooh yes. La la.
And he started a school for colored children.
Oh.
In the village of Williamsburg within the town of Bushwick.
Are you kidding?
I am not kidding.
Wow.
Yeah.
I want to do a story on Bushwick because Bushwick has such an interesting history, but I don't know that there's actually any like scandal associated.
I'm sure there has to be.
Yeah. Bushwick was like, before Williamsburg was shit, everybody called themselves Bushwick. Everyone, nobody wanted to be associated with Williamsburg because that's where the poors lived.
Oh, okay.
So you just would say that you lived in Bushwick, even though you really lived in Williamsburg.
Wow, that's so funny. Now that it's like the complete opposite. Yeah. Wow, amazing. But all you need to know about him for the purposes of this scandal was that once the war was ended, a newly created bureau called the Bureau of Refugees, Freedmen, and Abandoned Lands. It's kind of just known as the Freedmen's Bureau.
Oh, yeah. I've heard of the Freedmen's yeah. Bureau. Yeah.
Yeah. This bureau sent him to Georgia's Sea Islands as superintendent.
Okay.
To be the one who was going to settle these 300 freed men and women on St. Catherine's Island. So the Reverend Campbell, he split the island into, you know, these 40-acre plots for each family. He did not really have any real funds, so he got a lot of help from northern abolitionists and missionaries who were already funding freedmen aid societies at the time, like up north.
Yeah.
So these organizations, they donated clothing, seeds, sometimes even farming equipment to the island. So their first point of business as a farming community, they needed to decide like what their priorities were going to be. Like what were they going to grow on this land? Like they needed to find something that was sustainable. And, you know, they had to do it with basically no help.
Yeah.
And they were under a lot of scrutiny. Surprise, surprise, right? People are kind of looking at them to fail. And they had little encouragement and virtually no financial help from the government.
I'm sure there were certain crops that would grow there, but I feel like a barrier island, even if it's really much wider than I'm picturing in my head.
Yeah.
It's still probably not great soil.
Yeah.
So I imagine it was a hard task to find what could grow there other than cotton.
Yes.
Since cotton was already a thing.
Yes. Many northern businesses, they wanted these folks to resume farming cotton.
Yeah.
Because they had grown accustomed to a steady, cheap supply of it. But the newly freed people on the Sea Islands, they didn't want to grow a crop that, A, they couldn't eat.
Yeah.
Like.
No, 100%.
What? Yeah. Why were we growing this shit? And also, cotton's associated with slavery.
Sure.
Like, fuck all of this. So they decided, no, we're gonna grow what we need.
Yeah.
For ourselves. Like that's kind of the purpose of this island. In their mind, they wanted to just, you know, build a sustainable community.
Yeah, and sure, if you have surplus, you can sell it for a profit.
Yeah.
But like you take care of your own first.
Yeah. And they wanted to grow something that wasn't like so damaging on the land that like
yeah, growing cotton is,
like monocultures is not the way. They want to grow like multiple things and like rotate it as you should.
Well, that's, I was just going to say crop rotation. You have to like, you grow peanuts and cotton so that the peanuts restore the soil.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the community, they came together not only to create this like farming collective, because there were a whole bunch of islands that kind of collectively had government. Like, I'm going to get into that next. Okay. So weird. They created their own kind of a government.
Wow.
That mirrored DC. They they had a Congress with 8 men.
Wow.
They had a House of Representatives with 20 men.
Holy shit.
And they even had plans for a Supreme Court.
How many people in this area
on
total?
This island was just 300, but like there were a bunch, there was almost 100 islands.
Oh, I see. So
yeah,
collectively.
Collectively. I see. Collectively. Okay. Yeah. So Reverend Campbell, he was, unsurprisingly, he was elected president. He then wrote a constitution. It's wild that they were able to put things together so quickly.
Yeah.
But they did. They're just like, no time like the fucking present. Let's do this shit. He created a school system using his own money, and he organized a much-needed militia.
Wow.
Because you need a militia to protect what is yours.
Yeah.
So within months, because of Brother Campbell's leadership, St. Catherine's Island became this shining example of Black freedom and self-determination. And, you know, we can't have that.
No.
So as all of this was happening, Congress was already debating if they were going to take the land back. But the Freedmen's Bureau made this very tricky, made it kind of illegal.
They have a treaty or...
Yeah, there's a lot of debate on like what it was. It was approved by Lincoln. It was a field order that became part of the Freedmen's Bureau bill.
Okay.
Yeah.
No matter what it was technically called...
Like a lot
it's a legal document.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. A lot of people are like, no, Sherman did this on its own. It's like, no, he did, but then it became a bill.
If it was approved by the fucking president of the United States.
It's so silly. But yeah, I saw a lot of debate. I'm just like, whatever. So the Bureau, it had authority over all abandoned and confiscated lands. And they attached the marginal sale price to these lands. Because the whole point of this bureau was to encourage Black ownership of a farming land.
Okay.
So Congress couldn't just say no because they had just said yes, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
But the bureau was only supposed to last a year. Okay. And this is just a few months after it's signed. They're like, I don't know, we maybe fucked up and we want it back. I know.
You guys can't hear my eyes rolling, but
yes.
My eyes are rolling.
I think on the last MIDI I said, like, you can't hear my... My head shaking. You're like, you should get some beads.
Yes.
And you need beads for your eyes.
Yeah, I do.
For your eyelashes. Oh, man. So they set aside this land and they had like a really low sell price on it to encourage Black land ownership.
Okay. Yeah.
And there's no takesies, backsies. So as a result, 10,000 of Black farmers experienced land ownership for the first time.
Wow.
They couldn't have the land for free because, you know, their skin color, but they could buy the land if they could come up with the money. And it was a very reduced price. Like it was very fair. This all is great. But then sadly, President Lincoln had to go and get himself shot upside the head. And this allowed his VP,
Andrew Johnson,
now president, to veto the Freedmen's Bill. That wasn't even up yet.
This motherfucker.
And pardon a bunch of, you know, traitors in the name of white supremacist unity, as you do.
Huh. Fast forward to 2021. Yeah.
I don't know anything about that white supremacist unity.
Oh my goodness.
So enslavers got their land back.
Mm-hmm.
Johnson, he had this whole like amnesty pledge. If you took this loyalty oath, then you can get all your things back.
We love a goddamn loyalty oath in this country too.
Yeah. So this is May 29th, 1865. Like everything has been reversed. And this field order was in January. So this is May of that year.
What the fuck?
So as a result, tens of thousands of Black farmers were expelled from the land they just bought.
And they had actually paid for it
Paid for.
Like, who were they giving the money to?
I think they were giving it to the government, the Bureau. I don't know. I don't know.
What the fuck?
I don't know. All I know is they didn't get their money back. they just lost their land. It's fucked up. So, right on cue, Jacob Waldberg, who was the pre-war owner of St. Catherine's Island, he strolled back and was like, hey, like, give me my shit. Give me all of this land. Prior to the war, he had two plantations on the island. Mm-hmm. And he had 255 enslaved people.
Okay.
And he's just like, hey, you guys, like, this is mine again. And what do you think happened?
They stoned him to death.
Well,
I want him to be burned to the ground, but I know that
I don't know what happened exactly, but I assume he was forced off the island.
Oh, he was.
He was. Yeah, I think the Reverend like pointed at his militia, and he's just like, "Don't start none, won't be none."
Okay.
Yeah, he left. Because he came alone, the audacity of going alone.
The caucasity.
The caucasity, like, yes.
Nothing, there are no consequences for me.
No consequences, so. Yes. I am a traitor, but I'm allowed to get my things back. However, 6 months later, so this is January of 1866, a bunch of soldiers, get this, Black Army soldiers.
What?
Arrive with orders to protect Waldberg's property rights.
I hate everything.
I know. So it turns out this motherfucker had rented his old plantations to two white northerners who now wanted the freedmen, women, and children to sign contracts with them to work on their plantations.
Go fuck yourself.
Yes. These bankers, they planned to return the island to produce only cash crops, monocultures of cotton.
Yeah.
So the community was forced to leave because they weren't about to kill a bunch of black soldiers for just doing their jobs, for following orders. It was so fucking cynical that they sent
everything.
I know. So some of the black farmers stayed and they worked the land and were eventually robbed of their labor.
In the time that they were there, I'm sure that they made improvements on this land as well.
Absolutely.
On top of the money that they had paid for the land.
Yes.
I cannot believe that the government
took
that money.
Took that money and just gave the land back to the original owner. Just gave it to him. So the majority of the farmers, they left the island with Reverend Campbell, whose story I'm going to end here because I want to revisit him for sure. He did a lot of like really cool things in Georgia.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm going to end this here. I... There isn't a lot of information about the island, like what happened to it after that. Georgia is just fucking disrespectful. I did find out that at one point, at least in 2012, there was a historical marker in Savannah that totally did Campbell dirty. It said that he was a self-proclaimed, and this is in air quotes, self-proclaimed governor who ruled a kingdom on St. Catherine's Island.
What?
Garbage. I'm going to have to talk to Stacy in our meeting about this. It's garbage. To me, it's wild to imagine how radically different the history of this country would be if it didn't renege on this one really straightforward policy, or if this field order had been upheld not just for the 10,000, but for all 3.5 million formerly enslaved people. How would the U.S. look if slavery hadn't been replaced with sharecropping? If instead black Americans were able to, or were groomed to be self-sufficient economically, to build and accrue and pass on wealth like white Americans, Reconstruction probably would have succeeded if there was like power in the land. Southern states probably wouldn't have passed black codes. Do you know about black codes?
Yes, I do.
For those who don't know, these codes bound black workers to farms on annual contracts they could not quit.
Yeah.
They created our modern police force because it allowed officers to arrest black people for refusing to work. They called it vagrancy. And then they could rent out their labor on chain gangs.
Yeah.
So it's how we have police, like the fact that Reconstruction failed so miserably. But despite this all, some black Americans still managed to buy land.
Yeah.
Many came together collectively and bought farms. It's really, really incredible. In 1910, 14% of farms in this country were black owned.
Wow.
Yeah, 14%. So 218,000 black people owned 6 million acres of land in 1910. Almost all of that is gone now, mostly because of discrimination by the USDA. The U.S. Department of Agriculture, they went even further during this time to just, you know, hurt black people, because that's what you do as an institution of this government. They gave out crucial things that all farms needed, things like credit.
Yeah.
They gave loans. They gave crop insurance. They gave crop allotments, technical insurance, but only to white farmers. Only to white farmers.
There's an episode of the 1619 Project about this, right? About the sugar.
Yes.
Yeah.
So if a storm came and flooded fields, or there was a drought, black farmers lost everything.
Yeah.
But it wasn't just racist institutions actively sabotaging black farmers. Ordinary racists wanted to lend a hand as well. Believe it or not, the KKK, the White Citizens Council and the White Caps. Do you know anything about the White Caps?
No.
I'm not going to get into them. They make the KKK look good. So they were not happy about these black farmers like having a glow up. These people wanted black people to remain in their place, meaning sharecropping for life.
Yeah.
Garbage. So they were so upset by this land ownership trend in the early 1900s that they had to lynch and burn about it.
Oh no.
I'm sorry.
Laughing at that.
It's, you have to laugh because it's to keep from crying.
Yeah, exactly.
So they'd burn
a hilarious joke.
Yes. So they, you know, they'd burn down farm homes with the farmers still in them only after stealing the deed. So there are over 400, documented cases of these deed murders, which I'm sure is a small fraction of what was really happening during Reconstruction. But in school, I learned about the Great Migration with the spin of, oh, black people just moved up north during World War I for factory jobs, like, go capitalism.
Because they love cold weather.
Yeah.
Like,
they were running for their fucking lives. Like, it wasn't just opportunity. They were trying to live. Yeah. So anyways, flash forward to today. Black farmers currently only own 1.4% of the nation's farms.
Of course.
Having lost over 12 million acres to racism in institutional and just like private citizen form. And it all started with this broken policy of 40 acres. Unfortunately. So here we are with this terrible food system, which you know all about, and I'm not even going to... That's built on stolen land and labor of Black, Indigenous, Latinx, and now Asian labor. I didn't know about that until you did that mini Asian communities.
I don't want to, you know, bring the focus back to, like, white people either, but, like, we've done all poor farmers really fucking dirty too. White poor farmers
have been
dealt a dirty fucking deal by the U.S. government.
No, it's poor farmers, but like
obviously racism exacerbates all of that when
all
it comes
that,
to black farmers. 100%.
Our system is so fucked up. It's so broken, but it's unfortunately kind of up to these communities to fix everything.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it's fine. Whatever.
And then they get on a pat on the back when they do.
Yeah.
And we move along and keep electing white people.
Yes. But there are good things happening. I'm going to end on two good things that are happening right now. So in November, just of last year, Senator Cory Booker and others, they announced legislation that is, quote, aimed at addressing and correcting historical discrimination within the U.S. Department of Agriculture and federal farm assistance and lending that has caused black farmers to lose millions of acres of farmland and rob black farmers and their families of hundreds of billions of dollars in intergenerational wealth.
Wow.
So that sounds promising. My mom's grandparents had a farm.
Really?
In Alabama. And I'm afraid to ask what happened to it.
Mm-hmm.
I think I know what happened to it.
Yeah.
I'm like, now is not the time to be breaking my mom. So there's also this really amazing green movement called regenerative agriculture. Have you heard anything about?
I mean, I can kind of imagine what that would be, but
yeah.
No, I haven't heard
it's
of it.
It's like farming in sustainable ways, like not doing the monoculture, like big farm shit. I learned about it on the How to Save a Planet podcast. Have you heard about that
no.
podcast?
I actually have a lot of books
I'm obsessed
about this kind of thing. I don't think it was it like had a name yet.
Yeah.
But I have, there's a lot of books about how to
farm in ways that don't
our land without
destroying it.
Yeah, exactly.
And releasing a ton of carbon while we're doing it. So the host of this podcast, which I'm going to put all the information in the show notes, I'm obsessed with. It's a Gimlet podcast.
Okay.
It has the architect of the Green New Deal.
Wow.
Dr. Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson, and her co-host is a journalist named Alex Bloomberg. And I encourage anyone who's scared about climate change to listen to this podcast. You'll feel uplifted because they talk about all this really amazing cutting edge things that are happening below the radar and aren't really being picked up by mainstream news because it's like positive in our whole, the way that news is incentivized is with mess.
Yeah. Yeah.
But this podcast is really, really good. In a recent episode, the host, they took a trip to a farm upstate in upstate New York called Soulfire Farms. Again, I will put all the information in the show notes. To interview the program director and learn about all of their collective, because it's a collective farm that's black and brown owned and organized. Like, it's this really amazing collective of just farmers in the Northeast. And they're using Afro-Indigenous techniques of soil preservation that, get this, remove carbon from the air. Mm. Like, they might fuck around and save all of our raggedy asses from climate catastrophe. And it's the coolest shit I've ever heard. So yeah, so they are at the forefront of this farming revolution that's led by really small farms, not the big ones. But some of the big ones are trying to do it as well. And it's giving me a lot of hope and like an overwhelming amount of pride. So yeah, Soulfire Farms, I love us. That's, the end.
Yeah, that's really cool. I hope that idea kind of takes off.
Yeah, it's very new, even though it's like old practices. But like more and more smaller farms are farming in a way that does not destroy the earth and requires a lot, sometimes no pesticides, like the way that they farm.
We didn't farm that way until like the 40s.
Yeah.
Like it's,
yeah.
And in that time we have lost so many farms. Just the number of farms period has dropped drastically over the last less than 100 years, 80 years, because because of capitalism, basically. I don't even want to.
It's because of capitalism, but also because of the climate. Like these farms, because they're completely unsustainable, they're only doing one crop at a time.
Exactly.
Their soil is garbage. So when like a storm or something bad happens, it's wiped out. Whereas this, the way that they're farming, they're creating like a living ecosystem.
Yeah. And the reason that farms are disappearing, though, is not because they were wiped out. It's more because the big corporate agribusinesses are buying them out and sort of making it unprofitable to farm in these older ways so that they're being bought out and conglomerated or whatever into
they're becoming
area.
Like subsidies of like a larger farm.
Exactly.
Okay, there would be like Purdue.
Yeah. In say 1,000 acres 80 years ago, there would be 100 different farms, but now there's one.
Mm-hmm.
Because of Monsanto and Purdue and all of these giant producers who, because of monoculture, are able to produce 1,000 acres of like wheat.
Yeah.
And it's all automated. They only need like 3 farmers to tend 1,000 acres because of mechanized farming practices.
So this episode, they go to this small farm, but then they go to, I think, a farm in Minnesota that's larger and is doing the same thing.
Wow.
And is more profitable because they don't have to buy any pesticides. They don't have to buy any herbicides.
Yeah.
They use like geese to like fertilize everything.
I,
and like their output is more. Like they're making a lot more money doing things the right way.
Yeah, I could talk about this for hours.
Anyways, we're getting off topic, but
We need to have like a...
So I want to do a mini about something related.
Well, it's crazy the parallels between our stories.
Yeah.
But it's also crazy how much darker yours was. Mine was like they were forced out, but like they still got paid and they were sent on their way. They weren't...
Well, yours is at the North.
True.
They were
doing
a lot of really brutal terrorist shit in the South.
Yeah.
It's hard to be worse than what happens in the South.
Oh my God. Yeah. What an episode. Good times.
Well, I tried to end with some positive things.
Absolutely.
Like 150 years is not a lot of time.
No.
So we're still going through it, y'all. We'll get there.
Okay. I have just a little bit left. I'm going to slurp this down. Our drinks are empty. We are done. America's history is juicy. We just add some golden ass rum, some raspberry syrup and lime juice, and a sprinkle of racism. Thank you so much for listening to Beyond Reproach. This has been Tux Lerzel.
Stephanie Domingo.
Thank you to Tim Clough, our editor, sound engineer, and podfather and powerful wizard.
Yes.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for listening.
Yes.
Happy, air quotes, happy Black History
Month. Yeah, happy Black History Month. Enjoy it, y'all.
Bye.
Learn some things.
Yes. Do some learning.
Beyond Reproach is proudly recorded in Bushwick, Brooklyn. New episodes are released the first and third Monday of every month. Please note that we are not historians. We are just a couple of drunks who never shut up and love history. Full list of all source information can be found in the show notes on our website. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe. Written reviews are especially important. If you like us, please do one of two things. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or send this episode to a friend, family member, or someone you think would be into it. Don't forget to follow us on social media. Make sure you follow us on Instagram because we post our cocktail recipes the Thursday before each full episode. Please drink along with us if you are not driving. We also have a shop at beyondreproachpod.com. Get your merch, brand yourselves. We are on Patreon if anyone would love to show us some love and throw us some nickels to support the production of our show.